Hello and welcome back to the podcast. In this episode, I'm talking with my friend and colleague Geraldine Myrna, and we're going to talk about adult literacy. And Geraldine has worked in adult literacy for many decades, since the 1980s, and she's seen many changes in the field. So we're chatting about Geraldine's experiences of the early days of adult literacy as primarily a volunteer movement and how it's developed in that time. So this is mostly Geraldine's story, and I'm looking forward to her telling it. Welcome, Geraldine. We're going to talk about adult literacy and where it all began. And I suppose the idea for this episode came when we were just chatting at work one day and you started telling me the story of how this whole movement started. And I thought, this is a story that needs to be told. So I'm really looking forward to you telling your story about where adult literacy in Ireland started.
Okay. That seems like a big ask. And I suppose I'm very clear from the outset that this is my entry point into adult literacy. It's how I came upon it. And it's about my experience within the wider movement. And while I don't like taking up the sort of the dinosaur seat, I think it's interesting for the two of us to think about it, because I know you're very passionate about adult literacy as well. And I do know in times of trouble where I feel very conflicted within my existing job as a lecturer in adult literacy in SETU, in the Literacy Development Centre, I know that I go back to something inside myself that sometimes I can't even quite articulate, but I have a strong sense of a compass which helps me to make decisions from the very mundane, like, you know, what am I going to do with this group today, to bigger questions about, you know, should we have a postgraduate diploma to add on to our BA, and how would we select people, and what would the point of that postgrad be? So I suppose I find the beginning is important. And maybe even if this conversation isn't terribly interesting to anybody else, but if it gives people a chance to say, well, what was their entry point and where are they now? That would be useful. So I suppose my entry point, though I didn't know it at the time, was that my dad, who was a very brilliant and a very innovative and very clever man, was struggling with reading and writing throughout all of his life. And while he was more open with me towards the end of his life, and would have asked me for particular help with things when he was under huge pressure in work, it was never really brought to our attention. I mean, like many people who have reading and writing difficulties, there was a deep sense of shame, and he carried a deep sense of his own personal failure for a long time in his life. And so I suppose that was my initial entry point, is that I grew up in a family where there was all that sense of hiding and closedness coming from my dad, that became a feature of many of the adult learners that I worked with. And so for a long time I was in a relationship with someone who was struggling with all of these difficulties without knowing what that was the cause of the struggle. But I know it certainly made me very sensitive to a poster that I read then in a supermarket where I was living. And we're going back to the very beginning of the 80s. And there was a notice up just saying that if people would like to be trained in you know, how to help other adults with reading and writing, to come along for, I think it was one Saturday. And that was really it. That was it. The curiosity was up, you know, at that point. So that was it. And I suppose just to say, at that time, I would not have had a sense that there was a problem of adult literacy so general and so pervasive in the problem. I don't know about you. I don't know when you first registered it, that there was this pervasive problem, that it wasn't just a random individual here and there.
Yeah, you know, that's a good question. I can't remember, but maybe my education was later than yours, but I do remember getting a sense of it in my own degree studies, because I would have done a lot of training around adult education. So I guess I would have been aware then, but that would have been after the first International Adult Literacy Survey. So I suppose that would have brought it to our attention. But I suppose what you were talking about, that all happened before
yes
this research.
Yeah, And I wonder, yeah, that 1996, when the International Adult Literacy Survey came out, was the pivotal year. But I know when I saw that poster, it registered with me. And I think it registered with me because somewhere inside me, I knew that this was something of enormous importance for the person who had reading and writing difficulties. So I went off and I did my training for a day. And I think it was actually a very enjoyable day. It was based on the BBC had in the 70s broadcast, as the wonderful BBC did in those days, a programme called On the Move, which was very influential, because it started naming this problem and discussing it in terms of how pervasive it was. And it was the first programme that really attempted to tackle the stigma and the shame. And they talked about ways of working, about, you know, taking your cues from the learner and taking your initiatives about what was to be learned and how it was to be learned in on the basis of a conversation over and back between you and the learner. That really interested me in the training day. And so fired up with every possibility that I was going to completely single-handedly change the world, I went off with my posters and I displayed them around where I was living. And I offered my services to people to ring me, and that on two evenings a week that I'd be available to work from home on a one-to-one basis. Now, I don't know how representative that was of other people, but it was very ad hoc. The provision was very, very ad hoc then. And I think you were lucky if you got some training, and there may have been a coordinator in some places who would have done some of that recruitment, and then you would have worked at home in your house with on a one-to-one basis with that student. Okay. Or perhaps for some people there might have been a centre, but my sense of it then was that most of us were working from home from our kitchens, and I really thoroughly enjoyed it. I had no qualms about, you know, displaying my phone number, and a number of people called and I worked with them, and it was just one of those absolute aha moments, because I was stunned with how much I was learning about their lives, about their resourcefulness, about their skills, their interests. And it just didn't fit any stereotype that we had been accustomed to about adult literacy students. So that was my initial beginning. And then I started, you know, taking up volunteer work in centres, and I started getting paid for it as well. But it was a very unstructured, it was a very open environment, quite isolating at times, but it really was a groundswell movement that was happening all around us at the time. And it was very much positioned around a cultural and social movement that everybody could take ownership of the literacy problem, and that we could all play our part in trying to respond to it. And I think that really excited me as well, because I had done my higher diploma in education, and I love this idea of taking learning out of the grasp of the institution and recreating conversations about learning and teaching around your kitchen table. So that's quite a romantic view. There was another reality, which is that, but from a kind of why I was in it, these are the things that interested me.
That's fascinating to me. I mean, I knew it was volunteer led, but I really had no idea.
Yeah, no, because I think behind that, there would have always been, I think the success of it was that there was support, because something that was as flexible and innovative as that, where people could come and offer their service voluntarily and then leave when they wanted to, was always kind of destined to surge and then disappear. And I think the key was that there were a number of people who supported it. And certainly I'm remembering from when the adult literacy and community education budget was recognised, in that there was an adult education and community education budget. And I think, yes, it would have been the Programme for Economic Recovery and Social Progress. That was about in 1990. And after that, they renamed the budget and prioritised adult literacy. And then I suppose we saw more funding coming in. And so that was when the VECs officially became the funders, because they were distributing that budget. And that was when they had some money to pay for the adult literacy organizer position, which was a central role in it, and to pay for tuition. But again, I think that the value of it was that there was that support coming from within VCs, but it was very minimal support. It was a tiny budget. There was a figure that I was looking at recently, and it was pointing out that as recently as 1999, there was a survey done, and two-thirds of adult literacy organisers at that stage, who were the key people, they were the people who recruited, who matched, who assessed, who organised training, that two-thirds of them were still on very provisional, very temporary part-time contracts. And 85% of the adult tuition was being done on a volunteer basis. And that's only in 1999. Yes. So I think the amount of room that gave, I think, for people to take an ownership of it was probably possible because there was a very faint, but a very important structure that was in place to hold it together. That was a very flexible structure at the time, you know.
And I think that flexible structure has changed, though. I hear from my students nowadays who want to be adult literacy tutors, even on a volunteer basis, they find it very hard to get into to any tuition. They don't know where to go. There's no training on offer.
I movement.
Think so the passion for volunteering is still there.
Yeah,
it's for helping.
Isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
Because I think the volunteer movement had so much to offer. Now, it was always recognised that it needed support. You know, volunteers needed training. But then, you know, one of the arguments would have been, oh, and there's such a turnover that you spend a lot of time training and these people then leave. But there was a part of that in the early days that was seen as raising the awareness.
Yes.
It was seen as also bringing into the lives of people and an ability to have conversations with people within their community that they might not normally meet. So there was a kind of a social cohesion or social solidarity there of working with people who in the course of your day you might not meet, coming from maybe different places, different backgrounds, different experiences. But it was always a very rich experience, you know, to work with people. And then I think on the other side of that, as well, is that there was always that possibility that people came into it and they didn't come into it necessarily because they wanted a job. You wouldn't choose adult literacy if you wanted a job. So you had some reason. And there was always that debate about, oh, is this the charity model? You know, are we just going in to make ourselves feel better because we're helping some poor person with reading and writing? But that slowly was being chipped away. And we were seeing this as a human right, that everybody was entitled to read and write and to have access to it. And I do think by stripping back the one-to-one and the volunteer, we've lost opportunities as well to give people different entry routes in. You know, people from backgrounds where there are really significant numbers of the population with reading and writing difficulties, there was always the hope that you would work with them as students and that they eventually would become the tutors of tomorrow, or supporting tutors, or lead tutors, or volunteer tutors themselves. But it was the idea of communities being able to take this on themselves, or working towards that end. Whereas in a very formal, you know, system, those entry points, as you say, are very difficult for people now. And it's interesting that you're still getting so many requests for people who want to work as a volunteer.
Yeah. And I wonder, I suppose I see one benefit of this changing structure is that it recognises literacy students as professional tutors.
Yeah.
And you and I are involved in education for literacy tutors. That's our job. And so while I see that, I mean, that's a good thing that we're recognising that these are professionals and they work very, very hard and they are so creative in the work that they do. But then in the move to this formal accreditation of literacy teachers, have we lost something?
Yes. It's very interesting, isn't it, to think about that? Because I know the wish list would have gone way beyond anything in the early days when I was working the National Adult Literacy Agency as the director with Rosamund Phillips. You know, we would have looked, and there were two wonderful women there before me who would have set up so much of this work, Jenny Derbyshire and Pauline Hensey. And, you know, mapping out what we would have wanted in those early days, it would have been very much the idea that there would be, you know, a proper recognition for this expertise. You know, that the personnel would be paid, their expertise recognised, that students would have access, you know, wherever, whenever they wanted, to full-time literacy provision, that there would be centres, that there'd be adult learning materials, that there'd be different modes of delivery, that they could learn across different modes. And all of those things have come into place, including accreditation for students, that their learning could be recognised.
Yes.
But it's always that question of stopping and saying, is there something that we need to remember, that we need to bring with us, that we've lost here along the way?
And I think that brings our conversation round full circle, because that's, you started off by saying you have to go back and remember that, why you started doing this work, to keep going back to that, knowing what we're about, what our values and our ethos are.
And I think that's, that was one of the things that I think, perversely, that our qualification, the BA, you know, in teaching and adult education has done, is that it has, it has enabled practitioners to have that kind of space with each other, because that was so much a feature of the whole development of literacy. There wasn't a lot of funding, there was minimal funding, but there was an enormous amount of conversations and networks. And again, thanks to the Adult Literacy Organisers Association, who formed their own independent association eventually, they were wonderful for making sure that there were those conversations from students to tutors to them were carried to their adult education organisers and brought to a level that, that it could impact on the shape of the system and on the kinds of policies that it performed, that informed it. And I do wonder about that thing of, I suppose it was when we reached that point where we realised that, you know, adult literacy organisers themselves, must have been 1991, realised, you know, on foot of conversations with the department, that they were like the ghosts in the system, was how the department referred to them, that they were there, they were doing this incredible job, but it wasn't recognised. And that movement of that partnership between what was then WIT and NALA and the department was the chance, it was really a statement about trying to create a qualification that would embody those values and embody that ethos, so that people who were becoming qualified and getting some official qualification for their practice, that it would be, it would have grown from the ground, and that it could feed the practice on the ground, and that it would embody those values and that ethos. And I think that's where maybe it comes back to us, Karen, that we have to look at what's happening in our classrooms and ask ourselves, what is our connection with the ground? What is our connection with those values, with that ethos? And what might our struggles be in terms of trying to keep that connection?
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you. And I think that you mentioned connection, and that's something, funny enough, my students were only talking about this week, the importance of connecting with one another. They get the opportunity to do that within our classes, but outside of that, that's one of the things they really miss, is that opportunity to, because they do the work they do often at evenings and at very unsociable hours of the day, where they're not meeting other tutors, they're not in a structured formal workplace from 9 to 5. So the opportunity to connect is really important to them. And
I think that the other side around it is, you know, when we're talking about our values, is that I think one of the values that was really important, and it's so much more difficult to hold on to that now, was the idea that there were very, actually very few, going back to the 80s, there were very few resources, you know, actually published materials. And that was a challenge, but it also made it enormously interesting. A feature of my time, certainly now, I'm moving around the country, visiting schemes where they were organising their tutor training, is that the tutor training grew very organically. And it was really, you know, the VCs encouraging these ongoing training sessions where materials were created by tutors themselves to work with students. And people were always, you know, looking for ideas, sharing materials, making things themselves to work with students. And obviously there are limitations to that as well, but it was very much a movement that had that kind of breadth and space around it. And learning was really a very wide, you know, life was the curriculum. In so many instances, it wasn't so tightly tied to upskilling and workplace and an economy. It was a much broader curriculum, started, you know, with really what is of value, what is of interest to the learner.
Yep.
I do think the one thing I would like to say, that I feel most passionate about bringing into the classroom is the connection with social justice. I think, you know, that has always been a wide debate in the movement. I couldn't say that everybody was working that, and it's even in the beginning went into it out of a sense of wanting to challenge that systemic reproduction of inequality. Yeah. And if you think about it, in the 70s, we were told that reading and writing was universal in Ireland. It was only unteachable people who couldn't read and write. And it wasn't until something like 86. I remember the excitement when Gemma Hussey came to a launch that we were having in Nala, and she accepted the failure of the mainstream system and was taking responsibility and taking measures to address the adult literacy problem in Ireland. So that came a long way. But where we can't, it's not enough just to say that a system has failed groups of people.
Yeah.
We have a job to look at how we can challenge that failure.
Yeah.
And so we're not something on the outside of mainstream. We need to be in conversation with mainstream to see how we can correct some of those experiences that haven't worked in the past. And I suppose on that, you know, I'm very aware that there's a lot happening and a lot shifting in mainstream. But I do think in our own classes, and I'm talking about that in terms of SETU, I think we have a real responsibility to really closely examine the extent to which we are reproducing practices in our classroom that are reinforcing those kind of messages that marginalized people and damaged people's learners' identity. So we have a delicate balance in, you know, in a setting where we're working within higher education ourselves and awarding degrees to be able to raise those challenging questions about how not to reproduce a system which marginalizes people and makes people feel that they somehow are the problem and the and that they have failed themselves, you know.
That's an excellent point. And I really like that idea of walking our talk.
I think we have to keep coming back to it. And I do think arts is the way, because I think there's something about that conversation is a difficult conversation. And it's difficult because it's very challenging, because there are these practices that we have adopted and that seem to be rigorous and robust, but who's winning and who's really losing in some of those practices? And I think that's where our arts-based work really come in, because it allows us to have a kind of a really human space in our classroom where we can lift the cover on things and feel safe. And I suppose, if anything, what I really want to reproduce from my early experiences, I really felt part of a family. I felt part of a community. I felt I was with like-minded people who disagreed passionately with things that I said. It wasn't that we all thought the same things, but I did have a great sense of belonging. I think if we can create that sense of community among ourselves and among our students, the conversations will emerge that need to emerge to keep us connected to what adult literacy really should be about, you know, which is that basis of empowerment and voice and self-expression and helping us to grow to be fully human, you know, and not to lose that.
Thank you so much.
Not at all. You're very welcome, Karen.